Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's MBL on PRN.FM on December 9th, 2014. This edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take questions on the air, so make sure you ask them on our Facebook pages. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Background music for a couple of our regular segments, including the next one, is provided by 17-year-old Scottish teenager Rhiann Farrigan. On tonight's show, we discuss near-term human extinction, breaking into the mainstream media, the NSA and their shenanigans, the connection between food prices and societal uprisings in the weeks and in this week's Breaking Hopium by Forrest Palmer. We have also a guest interview and a new Doomer of the Week. And we close with, as usual, Guy's Climate Update. But tonight, our first segment highlights news beyond the mainstream echo chamber, and we'll mention two stories. Guy, what do you have?
From The Intercept on December 4th comes a story headlined, Operation Aurora Gold, How the NSA Hacks Cell Phone Networks Worldwide. I'll quote extensively from the paper. In March 2011, 2 weeks before the Western intervention in Libya, a secret message was delivered to the National Security Agency. An intelligence unit within the U.S. military's Africa Command needed help to hack into Libya's cell phone networks and monitor text messages. For the NSA, the task was easy. The agency had already obtained technical information about the cell phone carrier's internal systems by spying on documents sent among company employees, and these details would provide the perfect blueprint to help the military break into the networks. The NSA's assistance in the Libya operation, however, was not an isolated case. It was part of a much larger surveillance program, global in its scope and ramifications, targeted not just at hostile countries. The current documents contained in the archive of material provided to The Intercept by whistleblower Edward Snowden, the NSA has spied on hundreds of companies and organizations internationally, including in countries closely allied to the United States, in an effort to find security weaknesses in cell phone technology that it can exploit for surveillance. The documents also reveal how the NSA plans to secretly introduce new flaws into communication systems so that they can be tapped into, a controversial tactic that security experts say could be exposing the general population to criminal hackers. Codenamed Aurora Gold, the covert operation has monitored the content of messages sent and received by more than 1,200 email accounts associated with major cell phone network operators, intercepting confidential company planning papers that help the NSA hack into phone networks. Karsten Knoll, a leading cell phone security expert and cryptographer who was consulted by The Intercept about details contained in the Aurora Gold documents, said that the broad scope of information swept up in the operation appears aimed at ensuring virtually every cell phone network in the world is NSA accessible. Collecting inventory like this on world networks has big ramifications, Knoll said, because it allows NSA to track and circumvent upgrades in encryption technology used by cell phone companies to shield calls and texts from eavesdropping, evidence that the agency has deliberately plotted to weaken the security of communication infrastructure, he added, was particularly alarming. Even if you love the NSA and you say you have nothing to hide, you should be against a policy that introduces security vulnerabilities, Knoll said, because once the NSA introduces a weakness, a vulnerability, it's not only the NSA that can exploit it. It's as if George Orwell saw this one coming. Quote, threats to freedom of speech, writing, and action, though often trivial in isolation, are cumulative in their effect, and unless checked, lead to a general disrespect for the rights of the citizen, end quote. Mike, what do you have in this week's news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream?
My beyond the mainstream news this week comes from actually a very mainstream source, the Huffington Post, and it was linked on the near-term human extinction support group page by Samantha JB. You can find it on the Generation Change blog at Huffington Post, and its headline reads like the REM song, It's the End of the World as We Know It, and it was written by Dr. Randy Mullamud, who is a Regents Professor of English at Georgia State University. It appeared in the Post on December 8th. And the reason I highlight this piece is because it's another recent example of near-term human extinction seeping into the mainstream media. Professor Mullamud starts by highlighting another mainstream moment, which we here at MBL played a couple weeks ago, and it was the clip from The Newsroom, an Aaron Sorkin HBO show. The show and the clip are fictional, but the data used is very real, and it highlights abrupt global climate change and is a dead ringer for Guy's tone and language. This essay begins there and quickly moves towards some sombering realizations. Professor Mullamud proposes that it is time for us to accept as a premise in whatever environmental discussions we have, or indeed in any deliberations on anything taking place in the future, the fact that the world is coming to an end. Not the actual world, he points out, but for people and many other life forms. He points to a recent New York Times story that supports what Sorkin's fictional EPA administrator was saying. Things are indeed dire. The professor goes on to write that it's time to accept our impending demise. Those are profoundly difficult words, but they are necessary, he continues. Our times demand new rhetorical honesty. It is deceitful and irrelevant to sustain the charade that things may improve. Instead, it's time to start talking about how we will die. As depressing as this is, it is at least the virtue of being true, unlike the kick-the-can-down-the-road policies that pretend the solution of global warming lies in producing, someday, cars that get 150 miles per gallon in cities powered by wind farms, and expecting Westerners, the 12% of the world's population who consume 60% of its resources, to use less stuff. If there is a silver lining, he says, it is not a very satisfying one. But for what it's worth, he says, I think it may prove refreshing, even exhilarating, to develop a new trope, a new truth that lets go of the pretense that things will turn out to be okay. The progress narrative that has ungirded Western culture for a millennia was nice while it lasted. but it's also responsible for getting us where we are today, as it stoked the fantasy that we were invincibly moving forward and that our rampantly vivacious overdevelopment, exploration, imperialism, conquest, growth, civilizing nature had no cost, no limits, no consequences. As an English professor, I find it exciting to consider the possibilities of a new voice, a new style, a new type of consciousness. Other cultures at similar points in their trajectory, past their zenith, clearly waning yet close enough to the glories of the past, have often produced keenly insightful literature and art. Being on the cusp of decline provokes incisive self-reflection. Contemplating this scientific assessment, a parallel movement must acknowledge, better late than never, that we may have ends by writing what our last words may be, as on a gravestone inscribed with solidity, that we will outlast our mortal frames and will announce for eternity, even if it is considered in scope, what kind of people we wanted to be and how we might be remembered. This piece is another example going along with the show, The Newsroom, and Guy's appearance on the Tom Hartman Show, of really near-term human extinction finally making its way into the ether, into the mainstream media. Guy?
Yeah, this Professor Malamud sounds like a real deal. Maybe we should have him on the show sometime.
Yes, I contacted him, and he is game, so we're trying to set that up as we speak.
Awesome. I look forward to that. Thanks.
As regular listeners know by now, we offer opinion piece each week, and in Breaking Hopium, we hear from radical perspectives that cut to the root of an issue. This week's contribution comes from a regular voice on the show. Our colleague Forrest Palmer brings us Breaking Hopium.
This month, Hosni Mubarak, the deposed former president of Egypt, was acquitted of all charges due to a technicality concerning the killings he ordered on civilians during the Egyptian Revolution almost 4 years ago. With his acquittal and the Egyptian state saying that it will not look to pursue further charges against Mubarak, the Arab Spring has officially come to an end, with sadly not even a whimper, let alone a bang. As we are now seeing the end of this revolution that tragically has had no lasting impact, we can now sit back and make an honest assessment of it. Regarding the environmental portion that influenced these protests, the fact of the matter is that most people don't realize that it was the skyrocketing cost of food that was a primary cause of the protest. In 2010, there was a global wheat shortage due to crop production being affected because of increasing climate change and its attending environmental problems in Russia, Ukraine, Canada, and China. As we now are living in a global economy where the transportation of food is an integral part of its continuance, 50% of Egyptian calories come from food that is grown outside of its borders. On top of that, Egypt is the world leader in the importation of wheat. With this convergence of events, it was basically the proverbial disaster waiting to happen. Since we live in a society that is based off the crazy notion that markets are the modern form of alchemy that can take any diminishing or scarce resource and replace it with another, most people think that it is just the direction of financial resources into agriculture, which will control our future in terms of food. As market speculators can control or even collapse the wheat market, depending on their reason for making any number of manipulations, the X factor that supersedes the market ramifications of all of this is the ability to grow the actual wheat. As the Western world has delusionally viewed the growth of a crop as a byproduct of the economy, it has gone down the foolhardy path of making crops foremost commodities that are a major portion of the underpinnings of the capitalist system. Therefore, the certainty of economic implosion goes hand-in-hand with these food shortages in the relative short-term future. So all these factors regarding wheat are things that led to the Arab Spring. As the sun has now set on this uprising in any honest assessment, the only question is what will lead to the next uprising in terms of environmental factors. Will it be another wheat crop failure? Will it be corn the next time? What about rice? Or will it be fresh water, which is the additive all farmland needs to grow any crop? Or will it be topsoil itself, which we are destroying through various modern farming practices that feed the industrial food system? No one knows these answers, but there is no more combustible situation than the current shortages of food and water globally, two necessities for life. One day, these food riots will commence again at a level much higher than the Arab Spring, and it will encompass more than one region of the Middle East and North Africa. Inevitably, these riots will become an ever-increasing occurrence that will rise in intensity, just like the natural disasters that are being worsened by climate change. When will this be a part of our daily existences? Well, it is happening now, but sadly, most people just don't know it.
Thanks for that, Forrest. This week, we interview renowned independent journalist Dar Jamail. In late 2003, weary of the overall failure of the United States media to accurately report on the realities of the war in Iraq for the Iraqi people, Dar Jamail went to the Middle East to report on the war himself, where he spent more than a year in Iraq as one of only a very few independent U.S. journalists in the country. Dar also reported from Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. He has also reported extensively on veterans' resistance against U.S. foreign policy and is now focusing on anthropogenic climate disruption and the environment. Dar's story has been published with Truthout, Interpress Service, Tom Dispatch, the Sunday Herald in Scotland, The Guardian, Foreign Policy and Focus, Le Monde, Le Monde Diplomatique, The Huffington Post, The Nation, The Independent, and Al Jazeera, among others. Dar's writing has been translated into French, Polish, German, Dutch, Spanish, Japanese, Portuguese, Chinese, Arabic, and Turkish. On radio as well as television, Dar has reported for Democracy Now! And Al Jazeera, and has appeared on the BBC, NBR, NPR, and numerous other stations around the globe. Dar's reporting has earned him numerous awards, including the 2008 Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism, the Lannan Foundation Writing Residency Fellowship, the James Arison Award for Social Justice Journalism, the Joe A. Calloway Award for Civic Courage, and four Project Censored Awards. You can follow Dar's work at darjamail.net. That's an impressive bio, Dar. Thanks for honoring us with your presence on Nature Bats Last.
Well, thank you, Guy. It's good to be with both of you and good to be on the show.
We share a little bit of ancient history. My first real job after graduate school and a postdoctoral fellowship was as visiting assistant professor at Texas A&M University. I was a 28-year-old professor in 1988, and you were a student at the same institution at the same time. So please tell us a little about your early history from Houston to Alaska by way of college at one of the more conservative academic institutions on the planet.
That's a very good question. I was raised in Houston, which meant the odds were that I was going to have conservative politics. And so being raised Republican and that in that region basically meant not really questioning one's politics too deeply, just kind of like, well, that was the status quo. It's just kind of understood and accepted without questioning, which is, of course, part of the huge problem. But that's how it was, and that's kind of by and large how I ended up going to a school like Texas A&M University. And but towards the end of my time there, I kind of woke up and started questioning, well, what's going on here, and basically figured out a way to make sure I got out in 4 years and then left the state promptly thereafter. And after living in several places, I ended up moving up to Alaska, and basically just because I wanted to climb mountains, specifically Denali, and got into mountaineering up there. And I took a job up there working for a fellow who I ended up becoming immediately very good friends with. Dwayne French is his name, and he was at the time the director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation for the state of Alaska. He was a political appointee, a hardcore blue-blood Democrat, and was also quadriplegic. And so my job was to basically help him, get up and get into work and travel with him. And I really appreciated the job. I loved doing it. But the thing was, about 2 days into it, Dwayne found it necessary to question me about my politics. And so literally he said, "So what are your politics?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess I'm a Republican." And he said, "You guess you're a Republican?" He immediately turned bright red and said, "Well, what are the policies of the Republicans that you like, and what are the Democratic policies are you opposed to, and why aren't you a libertarian or an anarchist or a green?" And I had no answer to his questions. I had no political analysis or intelligence whatsoever. I became immediately frustrated. And I said, "Well, Dwayne, whatever they do doesn't really affect us anyway, so what's it matter?" And he turned even brighter red and said, "Well, think about this. The Alaska legislature is trying to pass a bill, And if it goes through, I'm going to lose my weekend funding to have a personal assistant. And so that means I would not be able to get out of bed through the entire weekend or do anything for that matter. So here's what I want you to do. When you go home this Friday, you're going to get in bed. I want you to stay in bed until Monday morning. Somewhere around the middle of the day Saturday, you're going to be laying in your own piss and shit. You're also going to run out of water to drink. And you're going to stay that way from Saturday afternoon until Monday morning. I want you to call me Monday morning and tell me that what they do doesn't affect us. And so thus began my political education. And I, we just talked daily about politics, and I started reading books, and shortly thereafter started reading everything Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn had written, and it just kind of blossomed from there. And so that's how I became politicized. And so by the time the Bush coup occurred in 2000, and then the events of September 11th, and then, of course, the immediate drumbeat for the Iraq War, I was completely flabbergasted. And I think I was in a somewhat unique position in that I was in my mid-20s, but to me, all of this was kind of like lifetime, real-time events on the global stage that were exactly out of the books I was reading, you know, about manufacturing consent and the impact of propaganda and control of, the corporate media and all of this kind of stuff. And so I was particularly, had particularly intense reactions to what was going on. And so when the Iraq War broke out, I decided, look, one thing I could do was go dive into Iraq and start writing about how this was impacting people on the ground over there, because this is what the real glut of information was at the time.
That's an astonishing story. And obviously you had a great mentor there in Alaska, although you perhaps didn't recognize him as one when you got started. So you were living in Alaska when you had your aha moment regarding the U.S. occupation of the Middle East. And tell us a little bit more about how that process developed and where it led you, where how you ended up going from Alaska to the Middle East, which is, for most people, not one simple, easy step.
Yeah, well, Alaska also, keep in mind, I mean, for most people certainly listening to this program are probably aware, it's basically a cold Texas. You know, it's all about, you know, it's extremely conservative politically in general, and it's all about resource extraction and militarization. Any state that can vomit up the likes of a Sarah Palin, that kind of gives you an idea of the political landscape there. So it was repressive living there. It was repressive kind of coming of age politically, and also infuriating because, of course, I was daily challenged or deciding to challenge people around me's views and what they thought was actually happening in the Middle East. And that added more fuel to my fire. And so I basically found a Lebanese man who was in Baghdad during the invasion in 2003 and was blogging about it quite eloquently. And so I wrote him and said, look, I've never even been to the Middle East. Tell me how to get in there. And so I went, I basically followed his instructions on how to get to Jordan, where to stay, how to get into Baghdad, where to stay once I got in. And that basically got me up and running. And I basically went in there with a laptop and a computer and a tape recorder and some notepads and found an Iraqi to work with me as an interpreter and basically started literally just sending emails back to about 150 or so friends, mostly in Alaska, about what I was seeing. And I didn't even know that I was blogging. I didn't think it was, the term may not have even been coined yet. At least I wasn't aware of it. And then a couple of weeks into that, someone said, hey, why don't you start writing on this website called electronicirock.net. And so I started doing that. And from there is where I started to get found by folks like BBC, who started picking me up to do some stringing for them. And I started doing some freelancing and getting paid. And that's essentially when I really officially started working as a journalist. And so it kind of blossomed from there. By the end of that trip, I was writing full time for some outlets, and then that set the stage for me to start going in and out of Iraq, and then I started reporting, really heavily. I mean, that basically became my life's work for the next several years. reporting on bigger and bigger outlets, wrote one book, wrote another book, and that really got things rolling. And, you know, but that really kind of set the stage to really get my feet wet and get my head around journalism, the media world, how it works, the importance of circumventing the so-called mainstream media. And thankfully, when I did that, you know, thanks to the internet and the tools it makes available, I was basically able to get all my information out, completely circumvent the usual channels someone has to go through to become a journalist, which basically, you know, frankly, entails brainwashing, going through journalism school, trying to practice so-called objective journalism and bullshit like that. And basically was just able to get out there and get the facts and get them out to people and get the job done. You know, it was a success. And ironically, you know, now kind of just carrying this forward into really what you guys talk about on the show and how I met you guy, and that I've, you know, your work's had a very deep impact on my perspective on reporting about climate disruption, is that, you know, there's this whole other world happening in regards to what's happening with the planet and where we are and how far along we are. And yet I find myself having the same experience now with climate disruption as I did in my first couple of years in Iraq. At the time, I was one of the only people over there reporting on how bad things were, that the occupation was a total dismal failure. There was widespread violence. Soldiers were killing innocent Iraqis and torturing them with impunity. It was just wholesale slaughter. And I was vilified by a lot of the media, even by some of the left media. Oh, the military would never do such a thing. I got death threats from soldiers online. I was completely shut out by the corporate media. And then, you know, just 2-3 years later, I had a lot of those same people coming back to me and apologizing and saying, hey, he was right. And I actually feel like I'm in the same place now, reporting on a lot of what you're reporting on, Guy, and using so much of your information as source material, because it is the best source material available, things like NASA reports and things that are published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and, you know, literally the best source material possibly available on the topics. And yet, you know, it's being completely ignored, as you guys talk about. And I feel like here we are. Now, how long is it going to take? And what else is it going to take on a planetary level for people to start saying, oh, these guys actually were telling the truth?
God, this is Mike. The work you've done is I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm just sitting with my mouth open. I just wonder how you work through the emotions and the fear that people or yourself may have of pursuing justice and putting that fear aside and, you know, just picking up and going to the Middle East, and how you dealt with that and still, you know, did the work.
Well, I think my sense of personal safety was overridden by my outrage and just like a passion for something like justice. And I have to admit there was definitely a revenge element that, you know, I wanted to see people like Bush and Cheney and all the cronies behind them pulling their strings brought to justice. And I was young enough in my political education and naive enough and idealistic enough to think that maybe my work would contribute to some of that. I mean, you know, here we have this Senate report released literally today that when we're speaking, recording the show, that shows in no uncertain terms there was rampant torture. The CIA lied. This directly, not that we needed any more evidence, but this yet again directly implicates Bush, Cheney, and go on down the list of people involved in his administration. You know, they're all war criminals. And
right.
Are they ever going to see a day in jail? Absolutely not. No, they'll keep giving their $100,000 lectures and writing their books, and so it goes with all of these folks, and so it's gone through history. But, you know, the thing is, I guess I felt like I had nothing to lose, because I felt like, look, if that's the kind of world we're going to live in, where these kinds of atrocities on a mass scale can happen, then I got nothing to lose. I'm going to go throw my body on the line, and I'm going to go report on it. And I guess I feel like we're in the same place now regarding the demise of the planet, where, look, what do we have to lose? Let's just tell the truth. And I think that's a big part of how I stay sane, is that, you know, I get to write these stories and interview folks like Guy and other esteemed scientists and put it out there, and I'm getting tremendous result for these stories and tremendous response. And you know, that's a lot of what helps me stay sane while we're sitting here watching the demise of the planet and more than 200 species a day at this point going extinct, and one massive report or one massive extreme climate event after another on a weekly basis at this point. And it makes my head spin, and that's, I do these monthly climate disruption dispatches, and even at that, I'm just barely touching the surface. Even with, you know, the one I published yesterday, you know, these are on average 3,000 to 5,000 words long. Literally every sentence is hyperlinked back to the source material, and that's helping me stay sane. And you know, thankfully, I write for Truth Out, which is an outlet that gives me carte blanche to do this sort of thing, and are very grateful for it. And here we are.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and we are talking with journalist Dara Jamil. Speaking of, you know, dealing with pushback, which Guy faces all the time, we've noticed that much of the pushback, and you brought this up, I believe, a little earlier, is actually from the left. Particularly Guy, gets a lot of flack from those people who work for groups like 350.org or organizations that are a little more mainstream and may appear on programs that are on, you know, CNN or MSNBC. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the pushback you felt in your experiences from the left, and sort of how you place that in the scheme of things. Is that more of a problem than really those people that I tend to write off on the right? Seems to be the liberal progressive left that has the issue.
Right. The limousine liberals, as I've heard them referred
right.
to. And I've certainly run into that. I think the most insidious form of that pushback is also the most powerful, where it's just censorship, you know. And that's what I found during my reporting in Iraq, is that if you're out there on the fringe and you're too far ahead, and I mean time-wise, and you know, I would say it specifically applies to what you guys talk about on the show and what Guy's writing about and going around giving lectures about near-term human extinction, and about what I'm writing about in my dispatches and the other stories that I'm doing regarding the demise of the planet. And the problem is that we're too far ahead in the mainstream consciousness. It's just starting to seep in, just as you mentioned earlier in the program, but we've still got a long ways to go before the average person walking down the street really understands the gravity of the situation. And so the type of pushback of censorship, you know, where you know, you're not going to see this stuff on any kind of mainstream outlet, even the bigger outlets on the left. If you talk about The Nation magazine or some of the other big so-called left-leaning magazines. And I think that's the most insidious form, is you're just simply not going to get these articles out there. So you're going to have articles, using The Nation as an example, by Bill McKibben or Naomi Klein, who right. are definitely still, you know, smoking the opium pipe, to use Guy's phrase, where they still think that somehow we can form a mass movement and petition governments or change things, and, you know, this kind of hopium stuff, which you know, is really part of the bargaining process in the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, where it's just literally a lack of acceptance of reality, and they just haven't, giving them the benefit of the doubt, I would just say they just simply haven't cycled through far enough through the Kubler-Ross stages of grief to get to acceptance, and so they're stuck in bargaining or one of the other earlier stages and simply not really telling the truth about the gravity of the situation. And that's about as diplomatic as I think I could put that. And there's certainly other ways we could put that.
Right. On the air.
Right. You know, Dart, it occurs to me that when you were presenting on the panel right after me at Earth at Risk a couple of weeks ago, you first gave a summary of anthropogenic climate disruption or abrupt climate change. And then for the next half of your presentation or so, you talked about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief. And it occurred to me when you were speaking that there's actually a sixth stage of Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief. Most people know about the first five, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. But it occurred to me as you were presenting with humor, and as I frequently do when I'm presenting using humor, that the sixth stage is gallows humor or dark humor. I think that's where a lot of people end up going once they reach acceptance, and I think it's massively underreported and underrated. Can you comment a little bit about that? Because it's clear that your sense of humor is emerging when you're writing and speaking.
I completely agree, and that's absolutely been my experience. And, you know, just real quick to interject before I get to that, as I stated in my talk that I gave at the Earth at Risk conference, I think I'm spending the majority of my time in the acceptance stage, although I do still vacillate sometimes back into depression and certainly oftentimes back into anger. But I'm certainly aspiring to spend more and more time in acceptance, and I think I'm making progress. But that said, into the coveted sixth stage, which I think is a brilliant analysis and should be added onto the Kubler-Ross stages, because that type of gallows humor, that dark humor, is a deeper level of acceptance where it's actually really incorporated more deeply into the psyche and certainly into a more livable way to be with living on this planet at this time and really deeply accepting this information, you know, that we're basically in a hospice type of situation with ourselves, with the planet, with the people around us that we love and care about. And, you know, what's interesting too, Guy, when you bring that up, is it reminds me is when I've reported from Baghdad and been even in places like Fallujah that are under siege by American forces and bombs blowing up around us, the Iraqis had an extremely keen sense of gallows humor. And that you'll read reports out of Gaza and you'll see the same thing. And I have friends that just came out of Gaza. I spoke with them last weekend and they said, yep, the Palestinians are still, it's so devastating and gloomy in there. And yet they're still cracking jokes and still maintaining that sense of humor. And I think it's a big part of staying sane, and I do think it's also part of the acceptance. And it's the same thing with being at, you know, here we are at this stage of the demise of the planet. And, you know, on that note, the joke that I brought up with Guy is I learned when we were talking at the Earth at Risk conference that Guy had recently eaten a Twinkie. And I shared just before my talk with the audience, I said, you know, Guy McPherson is someone who really walks his talk, because this is someone who really, truly, you know, does believe in near-term human extinction, because this guy recently ate a Twinkie. And, you know, anyone willing to eat a Twinkie knows that there's not a long future ahead of us.
You know, that was less than a minute into your presentation, which immediately followed my presentation, and you outed me as a consumer of Twinkies. And I'm not sure you had two sources on the story, by the way. Isn't that the journalistic standard, two sources?
Right. But I did. I'm pretty sure that Peter, your friend and fellow that's helping you out with your presentations, I think he verified it.
Now, you bring up an excellent point, this notion of accepting what is. And we are such a solution-oriented culture that so many people have a tremendous problem with that. Engineers, architects,
permaculture.
We're really very solution-oriented, and even the movie Interstellar apparently has this line that I think typifies this entire culture. Matt McConaughey says, "We'll find a way. We always do." And yet, this time we're in a predicament. This is not a problem. Problems have solutions. So math books have problems in them. In the back, there are the answers. And we're in a predicament. this time, and we've triggered too many self-reinforcing feedback loops. There's no going back. It took me a long time to getting to the point of accepting what is, and you're considerably younger than I am. How did you get there? I mean, I understand that you read Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky, and many lives have been ruined by following that path, by the way. What else? What sort of led you down this path of radicalism to the point of accepting what is instead of constantly looking around and trying to find a solution for a predicament?
Well, just talking about it in the context of the demise of the planet, what a silly sentence that is, right? Let's just talk about it in that context, right, as opposed to some other context. But anyway, such is our present situation. But seriously, just in the, not talking about it in the context of Iraq or you know, point to any other major calamity befalling us today. But let's talk about specifically with how fast the planet is being annihilated and us along with it. Talking about it just there, I mean, if you just look at the facts, and I mean, what happened to me was I had been reporting on environmental disasters. I kind of made my transition from direct war in Iraq in the Middle East to the major environmental disaster, the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Reported on that extensively, and then that was kind of my segue into climate disruption. And I was coming, reading the reports, reading the scientific reports, listening to NASA, just, you know, one huge report after another showing us how far along we are. And then it was when I came across your blog, Nature Bats Last, I actually was living over in Doha at the time, and truly in the belly of the beast, even more so than the United States, and was actually listening to Michael Rupert's show that I had found online, and you were on there being interviewed. And then so I was really blown away by what you were talking about, and I looked up your blog and I read your the thing that you keep updated about the assessment of an analysis that is so well researched, and there's all the hyperlinks. You can check out the sources for yourself, and it just completely blew me away. I mean, I think I took about 3 weeks. My wife was just watching me kind of obsessingly reading everything and reading all the links and all the reports, and it took me a while to process it, and then I got in contact with you, Guy, and interviewed you and wrote up that big piece I did for Tom Englehart on Tom Dispatch and published that last December, and you know, the title was something along the lines of Are We Already Off the Climate Precipice? And it was that's really what got me on the way. I think, you know, so in short, answering, you know, the summary answer to the question is that, you know, as a journalist with, and just a human, as with all those facts before me, there was no way to argue it. There was no way to try to pretend that, no, this isn't happening or this isn't real or it isn't this severe. I mean, if you read that assessment and look at all those reports and the credibility of them, there's literally no way to argue it if you're going to use logic and reason and honesty. The only way to argue it or to deny it is to literally lie or go into denial or run the other direction, just like the corporate media is pushing people to do and distract them, and certainly just like most world governments are doing.
Well, that's an interesting take, because I can point you to a lot of middle-aged, heterosexual, white American men who take serious issue with what I write on a pretty daily basis. So I'm not sure just having evidence is the whole answer. I think there might be something more, but we need not go into that. You went from the Middle East to the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico to anthropogenic climate change. These are not exactly the same topic. You know, so you're digging deep, getting to the root of an issue about a variety of issues, and I understand this is what journalists do. Do you have a formula?
I don't. I can't say I really have a formula other than I really like to stay on one story. I don't like to do what most mainstream journalists and even a lot of the bigger name journalists on the left do, is just parachuting in and going from story to story. If I dive into a story, I like to stay on it and follow it and keep going deeper along with staying up with it. And I like, obviously, you know, to do that, it has to be something that I'm passionate about and care about. And at first, obviously, that was the Iraq War. And then it was just kind of like going down the rabbit hole. You know, I couldn't start going down that hole and then not look at broader resource wars, and couldn't look at the entire Western and now global economic system that runs on fossil fuels. And then I couldn't go from that into, of course, the oil disasters. And then I couldn't go from that into naturally the impact on the planet more broadly of climate disruption and species annihilation, including our own, and then now to not keep going deeper into that. And so at this stage of the game, I can't see segueing off from this story and going into something else and staying on it. I mean, I certainly do other stories, usually environmentally related, but at this point, I just can't see, you know, what bigger story, what more important story is there than trying to alert people of how far along we really are. And plus, it's an extremely tall task. And again, you know, one thing that's changed is during Iraq, I mean, I was naive and idealistic enough then to think that that type of reporting was going to help in the U.S. occupation of Iraq. I mean, how idealistic was that? It was really absurd. But now I am under no illusion that this reporting is going to change anything other than hopefully let more people know so that they can start living their lives more accordingly for where we really are in the history of the species and the history of the planet. I'm in no illusion that we're going to, you know, install a whole bunch of solar farms and live happily ever after, because we always find a way. It's just what we always do. I don't buy that for a second. I don't think that my reporting is going to alter any kind of global policy or anything like that, or even really change much of the opinion of the broader so-called left in the United States. But I think that, you know, it's a reasonable expectation, though, to think that, well, there are some people that are reading it, and it is deeply impacting them, and they are starting to change their lives accordingly, and that I am seeing.
Yeah, I think what you've done as a journalist is you've made connections, and I've made some connections, and I'm not a journalist, and I know other people who are, you know, not doing research for a living that make these connections, but it seems that a large portion, you know, obviously most of the dominant culture cannot make these connections because the narrative is so strong. And, you know, Guy mentioned white heterosexual males, and that's generally the group I'm part of and I run up against as well, is they believe so deeply in the solution-based and the bootstraps, pulling yourself up, and we can accomplish anything. And it seems that they cannot make connections. And I'm wondering what that is. Is that an intelligence? Is that just complete denial? I was just wondering, you know, your thoughts on that.
I think, you know, I think the thing that makes the most sense to me is looking at it through the psychological lens, and it's just, where are people, which stage are they in the Kubler-Ross fight?
Right.
Well, let's call it six stages. Which stages are people in? And I think, you know, most people are probably in the denial stage, or, some at best they're at stage three. That they just don't. And, you know, and then, again, taking a more as a compassionate view of that as possible, and diplomatic, and giving people a lot of benefit of the doubt, and let's just say, look, this is the most terrifying, horrific information that people could possibly ever come in contact with. So, of course, they're going to embed themselves in one of these earlier stages in the grieving process, and they're gonna have to work their tails off and be willing to move towards acceptance. And so, most people, like, oh, hey, when you tell them, oh, hey, by the way, there's a gun to your head and trigger's going to be pulled real soon, it's going to take them a while to process that.
Right, right.
Yeah, final question, Dar. I'm amazed that our time has gone so quickly, but
What's next for you? What have you been working on? Where are you headed next in 2 minutes or so?
Well, more of the same. Continue on with my monthly climate dispatches. I've got a couple of big pieces I'm doing on the methane situation up in the Arctic, which you've written about and talked about a lot, Guy. That's a massive part of the story. And then most immediately, probably the piece I'll run next week is on Navy electromagnetic warfare game plans up here, because I just interviewed a doctor talking about how all microwave radiation, including cell phones, Wi-Fi, et cetera, is fundamentally dangerous to biological organisms. So stay tuned for that.
That's great. Speaking of methane, next week we'll have Paul Beckwith on the show, climate scientist at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Thank you, Dar Jamail, for spending time with us on the Progressive Radio Network today.
Thanks, Dar.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Each week we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo, but also provides insightful, useful information. Our doomer for this week is Karen Shulkin, who sent the following email message to me on December 5th. I just want to thank you for your work. I heard you at the Earth at Risk conference, and after following your YouTube with Hartman and reading your latest book, my life is completely different. I first felt comforted to hear someone going through some of the same grief I was feeling, and I felt alone in that and confused with what you see all around us. I couldn't make sense of it. Now I get it, and the sadness is gone, the confusion is gone, and the outrage. I think you are right. All we can do is focus on love. Now I just feel relieved in a deep way. Thank you, and I hope we all have some peace. And thank you, Karen. We're seeing the world through the same lens.
Well, Guy, you got a common update for this week?
I do. Several bits of evidence have emerged within the last week. But I'll start with a paper from the Mother Jones magazine published late last month. It fact-checks Aaron Sorkin's widely distributed scene from The Newsroom, in which the geeky climate scientist spells out the dire nature of abrupt climate change. Mother Jones concludes with this line, quote, "So in all, well done, Newsroom. Informative, accurate, if a little heavy-handed on the doom and gloom." In other words, information is dead on. It's great, but we can't handle the truth, so we'll call it heavy-handed.
I want to blame people, Guy.
Unbelievable.
So yes, is it unbelievable?
It's really not. It's as we've mentioned several times, there's a certain perspective that comes from the American privileged outlook on life, and I think this is one of those examples of where it leads. Okay, from the scientific arena, or perhaps I should say the crazy world of desperate times call for insanely desperate measures, geoengineering is on the table. Unimpressed with overwhelming evidence and public opinion against geoengineering, some scientists forge on, illustrating that the progressive perspective often means progressing towards the cliff's edge. As reported in the November 27th issue of New Scientist, initial efforts to cool the planet via geoengineering have taken shape and are scheduled to begin in 2 years. In even bigger news, the so-called 40-year lag is dangerously conservative. A paper in the December 3rd issue of Environmental Research Letters indicates that maximum warming from carbon dioxide emissions occurs about one decade after a carbon dioxide emission. My take, rising emissions during each of the last many decades points to a truly catastrophic future and not long from now. And that's just focusing on carbon dioxide, not on the beast, methane. Finally, a paper presented at the late November 2014 meeting of the American Geophysical Union concludes, quote, "Comprehensive 21-year analysis of the fastest melting region of Antarctica has found that the melt rate of glaciers there has tripled during the last decade," end quote. At the COP20 meetings in Peru, Newsweek and the New York Times report that 2C no longer represents a political target. It's only ever been a political target, not a scientific one. Well, it's been a scientific target for scientists completely unaware of research conducted within the last quarter century. And as David Spratt pointed out in a video from October 2014, 1/2 degree C was a more reasonable target that's long behind us now. And to wrap up, a new self-reinforcing feedback loop has emerged. It's number 21 in the ever-expanding list, and it comes from the December 2014 issue of Nature Climate Change. The, quote, representation of stratospheric ozone in climate models can have a first-order impact on estimates of effective climate sensitivity, end quote. In other words, the decline of stratospheric ozone as the planet warms further accelerates planetary warming. And to wrap with a story from the Associated Press on December 1st, a story headlined, Climate Funds for Coal Highlight Lack of UN Rules. I'll quote from the article, which points out the difficulty associated with using tools from industrial civilization to address a predicament created by industrial civilization. Quote, climate finance is critical to any global climate deal, and rich countries have pledged billions of dollars toward it in UN climate talks, which resume Monday in Lima, Peru. Yet there is no watchdog agency that ensures the money is spent in the most effective way. There's not even a common definition on what climate finance is, end quote. The bottom line of this story, about $1 billion intended to mitigate climate change has been used to fund coal-fired power plants, the worst emitter of carbon dioxide on the planet. Go ahead, Mike, with the last couple of sentences, and I'll pitch in as required.
Got it. That about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like to address on the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening, and if you miss us, make sure to find us on the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Gonna get you.